Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Are America's children suffering from nature deficit disorder? That's what author Richard Louv argues in his book, Last Child in the Woods. It was the subject of my commentary yesterday. I think he's onto something here. He's looking at the fact that American children are actually spending very little time outdoors. They're spending time playing inside. They're looking at electronic screens. They're doing inside activities. And what they're missing, he says, is contact with nature. I think as Christians, we have a particular angle on this question. It's going to be what we're going to discuss today on the Albert Mohler Program. Picking up in just a few minutes, first, a review of issues in the news. We've been tracking this expanding controversy. It seems to be a firestorm throughout the media on the evolution intelligent design debate. But I have been very much interested in this article that appeared in the New York Times earlier this week. It's by Verlin Klinkenborg of the New York Times editorial board. It was entitled Grasping the Depth of Time as a First Step in Understanding Evolution. He said something here that I think accidentally gets right to the heart of the issue. I say accidentally because I don't think Mr. Klinkenborg really meant to get to the point that I'm going to be making. But listen to what he said. He wrote this: "The essential but often well-disguised purpose of intelligent design is to preserve the myth of a separate divine creation for humans and the belief that only that can explain who we are. But there is a destructive hubris, a fearful arrogance in that myth. It sets us apart from nature except to dominate it. It misses both the grace and the moral depth of knowing that humans have only the same stake, the same right, the same earth as every other creature that has ever lived here. There is a righteousness, a responsibility in the deep ancestral origins that we share with all of life." Well, you could roll the tape from Carl Sagan right there. It's the same worldview. We're just all part of the same ecosystem, and human beings are just like everyone else. And he says, you know, when you look at the intelligent design movement, he says, let's just leave God out of it for a minute. He says, or the intelligence and the intelligent design. And he says, the real issue is that intelligent design is a way of trying to argue what we now know isn't true. That's what he's saying here. He says, we now know that it isn't true that human beings are special. Now, this is where we see the direct confrontation between the Christian worldview and the worldview of evolution. I think back to James Orr, a British theologian in the last century, who said there is an enduring antagonism between the worldview of Christianity and non-Christian worldviews. And here you see it, the enduring antagonism between the belief that humans are just one species among other animal species, nothing special, just perhaps a more developed brain, perhaps a more focused ability in language, but that's about it, and the worldview that says that human beings are made in the image of God, alone of all creatures, bear the image of God, have a moral conscience, a soul, a spiritual ability to know and to glorify and to worship the Creator, a moral accountability that is unique. That's where the antagonism really lies. There's the contrast between Christianity and non-Christian worldviews, and in particular, the worldview of the Bible over against the worldview of evolutionary theory. Verlin Klinkenborg wrote this in the New York Times. I'll be interested to see what kind of response comes to this. I wonder if people are going to focus on the same paragraph, because he said something else that I wrote about in my blog earlier this week. He said, and I quote, "Accepting the fact of evolution does not necessarily mean discarding a personal faith in God." You notice the "not necessarily" and a personal faith in God, but the God is not defined here. I think that's where a lot of people are going to focus. I think it's that first section that's far more interesting, where he says it really comes down to whether or not human beings are special. Just in case we needed any wake-up call to the fact that this is a pressing issue, today's edition of the Times of London reports on an event at the London Zoo where caged and barely clothed, eight men and women are behind a cage in an exhibit labeled humans at the London Zoo. That's right. The London Zoo right now has an exhibit, they say it's temporary, of human beings in a cage, and they're simply marked humans, like down the street will be marked bears and apes and giraffes. I'm reading here from the Associated Press. It says, visitors stopped to point and laugh, and several children could be heard asking, why are those people in there? The London Zoo spokeswoman, Polly Wills, said that's exactly the answer, the question the zoo wants to answer. I'm quoting from Polly Wills, the spokeswoman for the London Zoo. She said this, "Seeing people in a different environment among other animals teaches members of the public that the human is just another primate." You know, while we're thinking about the entire regime of political correctness, and when we're thinking about how these worldviews filter down into different cultural institutions, do you realize that what this story tells us is that the zoo is now a political institution? This is the spokeswoman for the zoo saying that the zoo has a point it wants to make. And that point is that humans are just another form of primate. Tom Mahoney, who is one of the participants in this exhibit, said this, "A lot of people think humans are above other animals. When they see humans as animals here, it kind of reminds us that we're not that special." Okay, Mr. Mahoney, I'm going to show that your comment is just absolutely full of holes. This is an argument. It's going to be like shooting fish in a barrel here, folks. Did you notice that no one interviewed other animals in the zoo for this story? Did you notice that it's the humans who built the zoo and put the other animals in it? Did you notice that these human beings, they're not on permanent display. They're not owned by the London Zoo. Why? Because we recognize that humans aren't just like other animals. That's why if the keepers of the London Zoo went out into central London and just picked up some interesting specimens of the human species and put them in the cage against their will, they'd be arrested for kidnapping. They're not arresting them for kidnapping the bears and the zebras and the snakes and the snails. Those human beings are going to go home and sleep in beds at night. They're not going to sleep like the animals on the concrete floor of their exhibits. Mr. Mahoney says a lot of people think humans are above other animals, but he'll probably not be thinking that way and not be making that argument when he realizes he's the one that was interviewed and not the orangutan next door. There's a new story out of Russia indicating that there are now more abortions than live births in Russia. I can't imagine a more tragic statistic than this. From the Moscow Times, I read here, "Russians whose lives are shorter and poorer than they were under communism have more abortions than births to avoid the costs of raising children." That reported by Bloomberg.com. The country's highest-ranking obstetrician reported that 1.6 million women had an abortion last year, a fifth of them under the age of 18, and about 1.5 million gave birth. Vladimir Kulikov, vice president of the Russian Academy of Medical Sciences, said that actually many more abortions weren't reported. You know, back under the regime of the Soviet Union, that communist, tyrannical regime made abortion absolutely free and absolutely easy to obtain. It was the promise of contraception? No. It was the promise of birth control? Yes. They said, go ahead. And this was one of the arguments that was actually used in the Soviet Union. The birth control pill will be too expensive. Abortions are cheaper. That's the kind of perverse logic. That's the kind of diminished view of human life. That's the kind of travesty that represented the worldview of the Soviet Union. And its legacy is still being felt in Russia. 1.6 million abortions and only 1.5 million births. And we know that there were actually many more abortions, as the head of the Russian Academy of Medical Sciences says, because this deals only with the reported abortions. Back a few years ago, the International Herald Tribune reported, and I quote, "An entrenched abortion culture in Russia and Eastern Europe has outlived the collapse of communism by more than a decade. The most startling statistics even then came from Russia, where abortion is used more than anywhere else in Europe, measured both in absolute terms and per capita." Folks, a society that aborts more children than it allows to be born is a culture that has embraced death to the very heart of its existence. It has brought death into the center of its worldview. It has accepted death as just a routine issue, a way to get rid of a problem pregnancy, a way to avoid having to pay for another child. The culture of death insidiously spreads all across the world. In London, little baby Charlotte is still fighting for her life. 22 months old, the courts gave the doctors there in a London hospital the ability to pull the plug on this baby whenever they wish. The baby's now at the Portsmouth Hospitals and the NHS Trust. Here's the interesting thing. Medical authorities say that this baby is making radical progress, absolutely remarkable progress. And so her parents, who want her to live, went to the courts and asked for this death sentence to be removed so that the doctors could not just decide at any minute to end her life. And the courts refused. They refused because they said she is still a perilously sick child. Folks, is that the verdict that we're going to put upon all perilously sick children? Is this the wave of the future? They're too expensive to care for? It's London today, Portsmouth tomorrow. It could be here next. We're going to be talking about the last child in the woods. We're going to have author Richard Louv with us in the next segment. You won't want to miss it. I'm Albert Mohler. Author Richard Louv argues that America's children are suffering from what he describes as nature deficit syndrome or nature deficit disorder. It's a significant problem, and I think he's onto something here because America's children are playing indoors. They're disconnected from nature. They're playing with electronic gizmos, looking at electronic screens. They're held in by their parents who are afraid something awful will happen to them outdoors. They've never met a snail. They've never picked up a cricket. They simply don't know what it's like outside, and their own backyard is a foreign territory to them. We're very glad to have Richard Louv with us on the program today. He's a futurist and a journalist. He's focused on family, nature, and community. His new book is entitled Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. Mr. Louv, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we're very glad to have you. I have to tell you that I came to know of you, first of all, through your book, America 2, over 20 years ago. So I've kind of been following what you've been writing. And when I saw your name and the title of this book, I just had to go get it. What are you really up to here?
Well, basically, this is something I think that many of us, and I know that I've read your commentary on the book, which I've greatly appreciated on the Internet. I think many of us have had this in the back of our mind, that something very fundamental has changed in the relationship between the young and nature, and that this has really profound implications for the health of our children, for their physical health, their mental health, even their spiritual health, and in fact, the health of the earth itself.
Mr. Louv, you really talk about this nature deficit disorder, first of all, in fairly poetic terms, and almost romanticizing your own boyhood, and I can connect to that. We're probably about the same age. I experienced much of the same. I have a 13-year-old son, and he doesn't have the same contact with the outside world I did. I grew up where I could just run out with my friends out into the woods. At least we called it the woods. It was really kind of an abandoned lot that had grown up. And, that poetic start really gives me a sense almost of a tragic loss of something here. But then you get to something beyond the poetry, and that is an actual argument that this nature deficit disorder may explain some of what is now diagnosed as AHAD and the fact that many kids, especially young boys, can't connect. That I thought was a really interesting part of your book. How did you come up with that?
Well, there's a lot of new research that's just emerged the last several years. This has not been studied very much, but for instance, very good research at the University of Illinois has looked at kids with the symptoms of attention deficit disorder and found that any kind of direct contact with nature play reduces those symptoms, improves their lives. And the authors of that research at the University of Illinois argue that nature therapy should be added to the traditional therapies of Ritalin and other stimulants and behavioral modification as a third therapy. And I agree with that, I turn that around a bit in the book and suggest that just maybe the incredible rise in the number of kids with the symptoms of attention deficit may have something to do with the fact that we've taken nature away from them in the first place.
Well, I think you make a very compelling point there. And, until I was really pondering your book, I hadn't thought anecdotally of some of what I've observed myself. And by the way, I love the quote from I think it's an 11-year-old boy that you put in here from San Diego, in which he said, "I like to play indoors better because that's where all the electrical outlets are."
Right.
We really have trained our children to have kind of an artificial form of fun, an electronic form of fun, rather than engaging the real world, haven't we?
Yes, we have. And that's been because of a lot of factors, most importantly because of our fear as parents, stranger danger. When you look at the statistics, though, the number of abductions of children has actually been on the decline for the last decade. A new report by Duke University shows that kids are safer now than at any time since 1975. What has increased is the amount of coverage that CNN and Fox and the rest of them give to a handful of very tragic abductions, and they play them over and over and over in an endless loop until we believe that there are thousands of these things happening, that there's an abductor at every corner. And this is profoundly changing the nature of our lives. It's putting our kids under house arrest.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. Let me also come back to something that that you said that really also connects with what I observe in, among churches, among families, and among all those that work with children and youth. You talk about the fact that, that some time ago, summer camp was a place where you camped, hiked in the woods, learned about plants and animals, or told firelight stories about ghosts or mountain lions. You go on to say, as likely as not today, summer camp is a weight loss camp or a computer camp. In other words, everything has to be organized and orchestrated and, for that matter, closely supervised by adults.
And there's this great feel of fear of lawsuits out there, too. The Girl Scout camp can no longer climb trees because of that fear of lawsuits. As you know from reading the book, half of the book is focused on positive things that folks can do, either in their own family, but also schools and the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts, the institutions that traditionally have cared about these things, conservation organizations. There's a lot we can do, and it is certainly, I've learned even more since I went on the book tour and since the book was published, I believe even more that there's great hope that we really can turn this around. And the first step is just to recognize this great change. And there's a lot of good news, because this new research, this body of evidence that's emerging, is something that every parent and every educator ought to know about, and they don't know about it, about just how great nature is for kids, for their development, for their psychological health, their physical health, you know, in terms of obesity, all of the many of the issues that we talk about, their stress with kids. A little bit of nature can go a long way, and the public generally does not know about that, and I hope that this book communicates that.
Well, I think it does. In fact, I like so many of the metaphors you use or imply, such as the fact that nature could be its own form of Ritalin. You know, instead of putting these kids on Ritalin and drugs, they may actually find many of their problems and patterns resolved by the kind of natural play that takes place. And I think one of the key points that really spoke to me here was that these kids need time to imagine, to fantasize, to play in unsupervised ways, where it's not so much just a game, they're just out in the woods. And, you know, if they want to build a fort or dam up a creek or, you know, whatever else, there's just something very, very important that takes place there. Mr. Louv, you know, I think a lot of parents are looking right now at their kids across the room playing, a video game or watching a DVD. What would you say to encourage them to kick the kids outside?
Well, first, I don't pretend that we're going to go back to the 1950s. That fear is real, even if some of the reasons for it are not. One thing we're going to have to do is we're going to have to be more intentional. It's not just a matter of saying go outside and play anymore. We may have to go outside with them in nature because of that fear, and so I encourage that. Part of the good news here is that this is not a bitter pill. Parents and adults, grandparents are a great resource for this. The institutions like churches and places of worship and schools, etc. Any adults who take kids into nature so that they can experience it, they get the same benefits that the kids do. The better attention span, the stress reduction, better physical health, all of those things that the kids get, so do the parents when they take them out into nature.
Very good word. That's from author Richard Louv. His book is entitled Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. It was the subject of my commentary published yesterday at albertmuller.com. The book is available at your local bookstore or online services. I really want to commend it. I think you'll find it very, very interesting. Mr. Louv, it's been great to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, when we come back, I want you to talk about your own experiences and what you are doing as a family, as parents, to try to encourage your children and protect your children and teach your children as they engage nature. Maybe a new thought for a lot of us, but it's something we need to talk about. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK, coast to coast. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Well, it's good to have author Richard Louv as our guest. His new book, Last Kid in the Woods, Last Child in the Woods, is really all about this nature deficit disorder he's talking about, with so many kids that simply lack most contact with the outside world, with nature, with trees and rocks and creeks and all the rest. And, you know, I grew up in Florida. I grew up in a community, certainly when I was a younger boy, in which I could go outside, I could play in the neighborhood, and my parents weren't really living in fear of serial killers or kidnappers or all the rest. My buddies and I could go out at the end of the street and cross one ditch, and we were in what we called the woods. It was a fairly large tract of land. Many acres, undeveloped. There were trees, there were sand dunes, there was a creek. It was just idyllic. And I realize that's a long way from the way my own son engages the outdoor world. This is a different generation. And of course, I think Mr. Louv is onto something. A lot of parents just live in fear. The fear that something will happen to their children outdoors. Organizations that used to take kids outdoors and help connect them with nature. Well, he points out they're afraid of litigation. The Girl Scouts won't even let girls climb trees. You know, there's just something especially, I think, wrong with the diagnosis of all these young boys with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, AH8D, or whatever they want to call it most recently. And, you know, he really does cite some very compelling research indicating that young boys who have a considerable amount of time outdoors connecting with nature and doing the kind of things the boys do outside, they tend to do better in school. They have a greater attention span, ability to focus. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I'd like to know how you're processing this. Parent, family, you know, what are you doing about this? But first, I also want to tell you that we as Christians have an angle beyond this. We have a dimension of concern beyond nature deficit disorder. We believe that the entirety of the creation testifies of the glory of God. And thus, we honor God by receiving the gift he has given us in nature and enjoying it and teaching our children to enjoy it and to respect it. And that's an important thing for Christian parents to understand. Let's go to Rob, calling from Akron, Ohio, listening on WHKW. Rob, it's great to have you. Go ahead.
Doctor, thank you. A couple of comments. Would love to hear your thoughts. First one on the attention deficit piece. I don't know if you have any experience here, but what I'm hearing more and more is we do need to protect our kids a little bit in that the images that are on television or video games are so fast that a developing mind, they just can't comprehend it like they can a book that is slower and they're going through and they're able to, as you said, imagine what's on the page versus see it happening in just microsecond images flying across the screen. That's kind of thought number one. Thought number two was you mentioned the word camping, and I tell you, I never thought our family in a million years would camp, but with a four-year-old and a two-year-old, we tried it a couple years ago. And I was just absolutely floored that our kids on a birthday, you know, they enjoy all the toys they get. But when we go out camping, my four-year-old son will see a stick or a gigantic tree. It'll keep him busy for 20 minutes. He'll figure out what he's going to do. He's going to build something. And you're right, the creativity just comes out. Lastly, just a comment on the spirituality part of it. Our priest a couple weeks ago made a weird comment, and it tied into what you're talking about today. He said that we feel that we need to raise our kids, that we need to keep something in front of them every minute. They need to be in front of the TV. They need to be doing this, that, or the other. He said, do we ever just stop and kind of relate to God or whatever, just kind of sit there and just think? I think he was talking more to adults than maybe kids, but do we ever just take a break? And that was kind of his sermon for that day. So love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, Rob, I appreciate hearing from you. You actually shared a great deal there. And by the way, I appreciate your first person about your own family and your young children and family and camping. I think that'll speak to a lot of parents, and it'll encourage a lot of parents that this really can be done. You can survive and come home with your marriage intact and the kids having learned a lot. That's great. You know, I want to plug into what you said there at the last two. You know, the reality is that there's a considerable amount of silence necessary if we're really going to develop the disciplines of the Christian life. You know, you really can't do that very well if you keep piping into your ears and into your sensory perception, the visuals and all the rest, that which blocks out that still small voice. You know, just reading scripture. It's hard to do that, standing in the middle of traffic in Manhattan. It's also hard to do it sitting in front of a of a computer or a DVD screen or a television. Speaking of the television, you know, Rob, you raised a very good point. Do you know that there was an outbreak of epilepsy among young adolescent boys in Japan given one animated cartoon that had too many flashes of light? There's the visual stimulation. There are pediatricians who are worrying that this kind of visual stimulation across electronic screens can actually bring on something like an epileptic fit, an epileptic seizure. Well, even below that, there must be a problem of some sort. Folks, the phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're talking about nature deficit disorder, how to overcome it, and why we as Christians should be particularly concerned. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back, folks. You know, I've had a considerable response to my column published yesterday at albertmohler.com. I'm really using Mr. Loeb's book as kind of a stepping-off place in order to talk about how we as Christians should understand that we don't worship nature, we don't even really romanticize nature, but we do understand that God has given us the created order in order to display His glory. It's for our benefit. He really intended for us to look upon the nature He's given us and to see in all of its wonders His own love for us. Now, there are those who worship nature. That's a big problem. That is antithetical to Christianity. We do not worship nature. We worship the creator of nature. But, you know, we really can't worship the God who created the world if we just ignore and neglect and despise what He's given us. Now, I think the language could be too strong here. I think most parents aren't in a position of saying, we don't want our kids to relate to nature. I think the reality is that we just realize now that we've got to use a lot of intentionality to make it happen. The society is kind of stacked against us in this. And tell me about your family, what you're doing, how you look at this whole picture. I know that some have already come to this conclusion, and I'm with Mr. Loeb. I do see some hopeful signs. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Give us a call. Let's go to Scott calling from Clearwater, Florida, listening on WTBN. Scott, it's your turn.
Hey, Dr. Mohler, thank you for taking my call. Great subject today. I think as long as it took us to get out of that, it's going to take us that long to get back to that. And I think we can look at our own childhoods and growing up in central Wisconsin with the seasons and the rivers and playing football and doing our own things. Those things need to be pulled from our memories, from our experience, and given and talk to our kids and express. We need to take the responsibility and initiative on those things. If they're so cherished memories, we need to give those to our kids and realize how important that is, connection to God and what He's made and incredible His deity in the world. It's missing. It's going to take that long to get back to where what we all cherish and remember.
Yeah, I guess, Scott, it's kind of like being reminded that all politics is local. All responses to something like this require, you know, the small steps. You know, it really is a local situation. I think, first of all, parents can all of a sudden wake up and say, you know, we really do need to spend more time outdoors. We really do need to do more. You know, my family this summer, we had some tremendous experiences. My son and I spent a lot of time fishing. And, you know, there's just so much good in that because you have to sit and wait. And honestly, he was more interested in looking at the alligators in the Everglades than I think even the fish. But that's fine, too. I know we're all interested in looking at that. And there's good reason to keep your eye on them from time to time as well. I was a Boy Scout. Loved going out. That was my territory. Went out there. And, you know, it was unusual even then, back in the 1960s, you know, to go out and to be in that kind of place. But it wasn't unique. You could go out there. It was well understood. That was a part of childhood, of boyhood. And, you know, that's just a tremendous thing. And my family and I went whitewater rafting on the Nantahala River this summer. Now that'll test your relationships right quick. And it's a survival thing. You got to get through this. You got to get down the falls. You got to all be in the boat. And you got to have all your limbs still with you when you get there. It was tremendous. We still look at the photograph and just smile about it. It was tremendous fun. Let's go to Mark calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Mohler. I just want to call in and say that I totally agree with what you're saying about young boys and getting them out in the outdoors. I have two boys myself, and we love to go camping, fishing, and hunting. And I've never seen them more alive and relaxing and enjoying themselves than when we're out camping. They also, you know, it seems like they like to get away from their mother a little bit too. And I don't think that's a bad thing, totally. You know, it's kind of a male bonding type of thing. So I appreciate you bringing it up today.
Well, I appreciate your testimony, Mark. Tell me, how old are your boys?
11 and 13.
All right. Now, I'm going to ask you, I'll put you on the spot here. Do they take their Game Boys when they go camping, or is this the kind of camping where it's just you, me, and nature?
You, me, and nature.
All right. I had a feeling that's the point you're going to make, Mark, and I appreciate it. You know, our kids have become so addicted to so many of these electronic games and gadgets and all the rest, they wouldn't know what to do if they actually got somewhere where they were going to have to create their own entertainment and their own visuals and their own audio, and maybe just have to listen to what a frog's going to say sitting on the creek bank. That would be a revolution. Mark, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Steve calling from Charlie Boy, Michigan, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Go right ahead, Steve.
Good day, Mr. Mueller. It's great to hear your voice again, and I listen to you every day regularly. My comment is that my children, my oldest boy is 33 and my youngest boy is 27, were both born and raised here in the northern Michigan woods, and we enjoy hunting, fishing, camping, and all of the outdoors, and I just make the comment that children who are influenced by nature understand that the human race is not as superior as most of us think it might be, that the Creator is the superior being who gives us all these gifts.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? That, in fact, only a sovereign, wonderful, omniscient, omnipotent creator could have done this. You know, I appreciate your call, Steve. I was talking to a group of students just last night, and one of the points I was trying to make to them is that the Christian doctrine of creation is so much bigger in terms of its meaning and its scope than most Christians ever imagine. Here's the deal. The Bible tells us that the story of creation is a part of the story of redemption. In Romans chapter 8, Paul writes that the creation is groaning under the effects of sin. It is waiting for the revelation of the Son of God. It is anticipating its restoration and redemption. That's a very important issue here. God created this world, this entire universe, this cosmos, in order that he would save a people on this planet from their sins by the work of his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. That's the purpose of all of this. And that is an audacious truth claim. Let's just recognize that. This Christian doctrine of creation is a huge truth claim. It transforms the way you look at everything. God cared so much for us that he sent his Son. That's the story of salvation, so that all who believe in him might have life and life everlasting. He gave his Son. But what Christ did on the cross was reflected even in creation. And creation is even now awaiting the redemption that is to come. That's why at the end of the book, we find the promise of a new heaven and a new earth. But God so loved us that he did this. And he so loved what he was going to do that he created a world of nearly infinite and immeasurable wonder to testify how important his work was going to be. Yes, you know, this puts us in our place. We're not the creator, we're the creature. But we're the only creature who knows the creator. We know what this is and what this world means, and we know who made it. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. We're talking about the last child in the woods, nature deficit disorder, and how we as Christians can respond. I'm Albert Mueller. Well, folks, it is interesting, isn't it, just to ponder the last hour of our conversation. You know, the callers were guys. They were calling in, and most were kind of reflecting on their own childhood, and all were apparently dads talking about how they want to help their own children to connect to nature, be outside in the wilderness, in the woods, in the forest, or for that matter, in the desert or on the water, you know, wherever we're able to make that connection and whatever your particular hobby or interest would take you. It reminds me of an article that I mentioned in my weblog this week. It's by Midge Dechter, and she didn't write it recently. She wrote it some time ago, but it hasn't been available until just recently on the web, and it's available in an online edition in full text now. That's why I wrote the article. It's entitled The Battle of the Sexes, What Are Little Boys Made Of? I posted it just yesterday on Thursday. You can find it at Albert Mohler. That's MOHLER.com. Just go to the blog and you'll find it there. And you can find the link right to Midge Dechter's article, What Are Little Boys Made Of? Listen to what she says here. This is just a brief excerpt. She says, somewhere on the way to and from the 1960s, something happened in America to suppress this natural condition of boys. Some loss of energy, some shying away from their instinctive restlessness and competitiveness, and with it, a fading of whatever happened to be the standards of gallantry. It's not easy to say what brought this about. Our mores of child-rearing certainly had a lot, if not everything, to do with it. In the end, what really matters is that the process of damping their natures, which would prove so fateful to them and to the rest of us during the years of Vietnam War, was applauded by the keepers of the national ethos, the intellectuals, the educators, the clergy, and the press. Midge Dechter will make you think. She's always a provocative writer. She's a fascinating figure in and of herself, a part of the New York intellectual crowd, but she's always had a counter message. And one of her big concerns for years has been that the feminists appeared to have largely succeeded in redefining men and masculinity in boys as well. She wants to fight back. Her article, What Are Little Boys Made Of? Well, you'll find a lot of thought-provoking material in it. You can find the link to it at my web at albertmohler.com. But the big point she wants to make is this. Boys are different. We need to recognize they have particular needs. There's a particular need within them for competitiveness. There's a particular need for the kind of roughhousing and the kind of play that boys enjoy. And there's a particular need for boys not to be turned into little girls in terms of expectation, in terms of activity. You know, one of the problems with all of this in terms of classroom and the educational crisis and when they're talking about attention deficit disorder and all the rest, yes, there's some real problems there. But a lot of it is just little boys being little boys. Richard Louv, I think, persuasively argues that maybe if you take them out and let them play outdoors for a while, connect with nature and find themselves in the great scheme of things, you'll find their attention may actually be lengthened. And there'll be other benefits as well. Benefits that we as Christian believers understand comes from honoring the Creator of the cosmos. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. We'll meet you next time.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.